Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to Pass Gas. This week, it's part one of two on the history of Alfa Romeo. This episode, a lot of cool cars, also a lot of hard pronunciations for me.
Yeah, how about a 27-liter four-cylinder engine? A V12 with five superchargers that never got to race, unfortunately.
How about that?
And what's up with that weird logo? Let's all find out together.
Bart's here.
Let's get into it. It's a podcast. I should have said something.
Winter 1945. Alfa Romeo's newly appointed chief designer, Ozzario Sattapulliga, steps through the rubble of the bombed-out Alfa Romeo factory in Portella, Milan, where it had stood since the company's inception in 1906. Shattered racing trophies are strewn about, covered in dust, an apt metaphor for the iconic company's past and present. Alfa's benefactor, the Italian government, was on the losing side of World War II, which had ended just a few months earlier. Auto production had been shut down for years, and the fate of the company now hangs in the balance. Sada spots a dusty tarp as he walks through the ruins.
That's a dusty tarp.
And pulls it to the floor, revealing a surviving race car prototype from before the war. He has an idea. He returns to what once had been his office and digs out some kind of wrinkled, rudimentary blueprints and smiles. Today on Pass Gas, it's part one of a two-part series on Alfa Romeo. What is the origin story of this legendary Italian company? How is it closely intertwined with Ferrari? And how did the company survive the Great Depression, two world wars, and murder?
Pass Gas Podcast, it's about cars, it's not about
Bart's back.
What the heck?
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey,
We're so happy to have you.
Yeah, it was fun last time.
It was very fun. It felt great.
Two-parter.
It felt like we jumped back into just working at the old office again.
And felt great.
Snapped into it.
Good. Welcome to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Across me, the aforementioned, the incomparable.
I thought you were going to say incompetent.
Incompetent.
How many I words does he have?
Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Thanks for
back.
Me. Thank you.
You're welcome, dude. Thanks. And next to me, Joe Weber.
Slime off a slug's back. Wink, wink. Nation.
set me up. Set me up.
And that voice, that smoky, dusty tarp of a voice you hear is Nolan Sykes.
Sucking down beans in my 6.4. What's up? How we doing?
You want to tell a story?
So this is older news at this point, I think, but we were at Car Week last week for like less than 24 hours. But we went to this event that I think Hemmings was putting it on, and their catering was done by a barbecue joint. And I was just eating my beans by myself, and Joe comes up.
There's the Easy E song was playing in the background, or a remix of it.
A remix of the Easy E song, and then Joe, you hit me with that.
Yeah, because you're sucking down beans, and it sounds like rolling down the street, almost.
And then you pulled up your phone, and you're like, "Go do it."
That's how most things happen at Donut. Yeah. Is they just say, "Do it." You know, it'd be really stupid. Do it.
Love
so
the stories.
We did it one time before. We haven't even gotten feedback if people actually like this segment or not, but I want to keep doing it because I love snacks. This is a road trip podcast. I get so many DMs that are like, I binged a million episodes on my way to Tucson. I want to figure out the best road trip snack, and we're going to go through all the snacks if we have to find it. But I have a kooky one today.
Okay.
I hope you guys are ready for
go
this.
Go ahead, yeah. Oh, he's brought it with him.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Sour Patch Oreos.
Oh, I'm so intrigued.
Yeah, try one.
Oh, this should be interesting. You know, I heard something quite intriguing.
Joe, ate almost all of them already.
There's like a whole row is gone. This is a small package.
When did you get those? I got them on my way into work.
All right, first I'm going to do... Oh, they do smell like Sour Patch.
It's way more Sour Patch than it is Oreo.
That's so bizarre. Okay.
Oof. Just smelling it.
Yeah. Pungent.
Oh.
No. It's not bad.
It's surprisingly good, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's got the Sour Patch like fruitiness to it, but still retains the trademark Oreo kind of creaminess.
They put a lot of sour powder in the cream.
Mm-hmm.
Did you put it back in there?
No, it's in the can. Oh. I'm not eating anymore. It's like the worst. It's like if a creamsicle was worse, is what it tastes like. Because it's too sour. I don't like the sour with the creaminess. Mm-hmm. It's not for
I
me.
Like the sour, but what I don't like. Actually, I'll have one more of those.
You do like it.
I do like it.
I can see how someone would that.
Probably never buy these.
Yeah.
But
I had to buy it. It was weird.
What's weird is the sour flavor profile with the crunchiness.
I know. And I think they stuffed the cream full a lot of that sour powder, mm-hmm. and then they put the gummies in the cookie, which is weird. But the sour powder is like a homing missile for the one tooth that gets real tingly.
Yes.
And so it's just packed in there. It's hurting my tooth right now.
You should
I feel like
dentist.
I'm definitely lost.
Never.
Time. I don't think.
I think I have heart disease now.
From the cookie?
I think I do. Interesting thing about Oreos, they have flavors like that and like pumpkin and candy corn and
There's
all
There's a Coca-Cola one coming out.
What?
Coca-Cola Oreo coming out.
I think someone explained it to me that it's just to take up space on the shelf.
Yes.
Versus their competition.
Yeah. This is what...
Weren't we just talking about... That was like last week as we were eating lunch.
Weren't we? Like we were talking about beers?
Yeah, beers and Coke and whoever.
Oh, yeah. Coke. You told me that. Yeah. You were like, Coke has all these goofy flavors. Not so they can sell them, but so they can take up more space.
So that someone was actually Bart.
Yeah.
And now we are full circle on this conversation. Yeah. And
I will see you guys next week.
Yeah. All right. See ya. Nolan, what's your score out of 10?
Weird out of 10. Would not buy for a road trip.
Ineligible for a score?
No. Okay. So out of 10, I'd give that... Probably give it a 5. It's middle of the road.
You're done with one.
Yeah.
Done in one.
Exactly. I feel sick now.
Like a road trip snack is something that you should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel
going
sick.
Back
truly.
So if you had to put that into a numerical value.
Sick. Okay. Probably a 3 actually.
3 out of 10.
No, it's like if you're sick twice, that's 6.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So Bart, I'll go with that. You didn't really like it that much. What's
I didn't
your
like
score?
That much. I don't know, 2.
2 out of 10?
I can't see doing that on a road trip. Yeah. And then, all right, the other thing is it's like, crap, why did I buy these? It's the only thing I have. And then you feel like absolute crap.
Oh, yeah.
Not just physically, but about yourself.
Yeah.
When you're finished.
I think that's what's making me more ill right now is the fact that I did go for that second one. I feel like, come on, man, I'm better than that.
Yeah.
I should be better than that, but I'm not.
I'd much rather have just a bag of Sour Patch Kids or Oreos.
I love Sour Patch Kids.
These don't need
and
to be.
And then if the mood strikes, you could do it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm giving it 3.5 just because I think it. Anyways.
I feel it right here, like in my sternum, underneath my sternum. There's something just like evil now.
That.
I don't like it.
Well, Sour Patch Kids are evil and then they're sweet.
Oh, yeah. They're sweet and then they're sour.
Oh, that's what it is.
Or they're sour, then they're sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. You nailed it. Okay. Interesting find. Thanks for bringing those in. I'm looking forward to eating more snacks.
Yeah.
On the show here.
We often run through lunch on this, so.
Oh, that's why.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Okay. So, I was going to ask you guys what you guys think of Alfa Romeo. I don't have an Alfa Romeo.
We don't have.
I don't have any.
No one's cruising with their longboard.
No. Okay. No. The only times I see Alfa Romeos are when I go to. I've been to Deus like twice.
Yeah.
And those are the only places I see.
You see a lot of them in LA. Those old two-seater.
There's always, some dude who's like probably a former like creative director at some huge company, has like an immaculate Alpha.
But there's also crappy ones. There's a ton of crappy.
There's crappy ones?
Yeah, like missing the top.
Okay.
Like vinyl completely.
The whole top's not
you're
even on
like
there.
So you're talking about the spiders, the convertible.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of like the little coupes, the little a little
the coupes, I think people take better care of the coupes.
For sure.
I saw one at Brent's birthday, like a 66 something or other. Mm-hmm. It was clean and
nice.
Everyone, it's a head turner. No matter, there is a million cool cars at this birthday. That thing rolled up. Oh, yeah. There's a million cool cars at this birthday, and that thing rolled up, and everyone just stopped their conversation. It was like, oh, yeah. Oh, You know, Giorgetto designed that when he was 18 or something.
Let's get in it.
All right, let's get in it. Indeed. You watch a lot of Bluey? Your household?
Dude, we got...
Sorry. Is this related to Alfred?
It's not at all, but it just popped up. You know, I'm trying to...
Sure. What are you, yeah. Are you reading or are you...
I'm not reading.
Browsing. Yeah.
He has questions. Ask Bart about
Interject.
Bluey.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk after the show, I guess. The origins of Alfa Romeo date back to 1906, when French automobile manufacturer Alexandre Darroch partnered with the Italian aristocrat Ugo Stella to form Società Anonima Italiana Darroch. I'm trying my best here, folks.
Società Anonima Italiana Darroch.
Exactly what I said. Or... said SAID. They built their first plant in Portello, a suburb of Milan, with plans to build and sell Darroch's French cars in Italy. Unfortunately, though, said's vehicles were considered too small and underpowered for the mountainous terrain of northern Italy. The business, as a result, floundered, and in 1910, Darroch signed the business over to a new partnership group, Anonima
Alfa.
We can Anonima Lombarda Fabbrica Automobili, or Alfa for short. Thank you, Bart. Yeah. The company.
That's crazy. Imagine building a car that can't go uphill and being like, shit. You know, like, ah.
Ah, man. Huge man. Oversight.
The company was now under total Italian ownership, and designer Romano Cattaneo sought to design an emblem to match the company's roots.
Here we go, Joe.
He combined the red cross from Milan's flag with the symbol of Milan, the Biscione, a divine serpent giving birth to a royal child.
Wow, okay.
Considering this original emblem closely resembles the badge on its cars today, it's safe to say he nailed it.
Yeah, I thought in my head it's a cross, but that's the like blue cross, blue mm-hmm. shield. Snake on a sword, right?
Yeah, that's what you're thinking of?
That's what I'm thinking of. Sorry. Yeah, yeah, in my head it was a sword.
I forget what that is called, actually.
Very interesting. Cool logo. Alpha's early leaders shot off the starting line. One of their first
Caduceus.
Moves was...
Caduceus?
Yes, that's what you're thinking of.
That sounds like a joke from Workaholics or something. A Caduceus.
Sorry, no, go ahead.
Alfa's early leaders shot off the starting line. One of their first moves was hiring engineer and designer Giuseppe Morosi to be the company's first managing director. Morosi was considered an engineering prodigy. In his early 20s, he established his own bicycle and motorcycle manufacturing firm, which eventually led to his employment at Bianchi.
Bianchi.
I think there should be a drinking game where when Nolan mispronounces something...
He's usually
so
very good.
Italian is hard.
Yeah.
Because I know that I'm just doing it like the normal corn-fed American way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the older I get, the more I learn that there's actually a lot of nuance to Italian pronunciation that I was not privy to.
Yeah.
Well, there's I had an English professor who used to pronounce Don Quixote.
Ah. Oh.
And his argument that look, we speak English. And... you know, in hindsight, that's a pretty closed-minded argument.
Yeah.
But he's like, we say Milan, we say Florence, we say Don Quixote. And I just remember being like, oh. And out here, there's all the Quixote trucks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every time.
For movies. And every time, it's Quixote.
It's Quixote.
That's funny. It's going to seep into your vernacular at some point.
So Morosi was at Bianchi, and then he jumped to Fiat, where he worked for on the company's early dominant race cars, including the 14-liter,
which is
four-cylinder S74 Grand Prix GP. That's insane.
This was on the cylinders video we did a while ago of the craziest engines. I think it had
RPMs. Four cylinder, 14.
Four.
Oh. This thing's sick. Okay, I feel like this was on Top Gear or something. Anyway,
It has a nickname though.
For an upstart, isn't it the Beast of Milan or something?
Yeah, Beast of Turin.
Beast of Turin. Mm. My bad. For an upstart with rocky beginnings, landing a rising star of this caliber was a huge win. The early 1910s were a period of rapid and important development for the company. Morosi's first design was the 24 HP road car, and it set the standard for what we expect from Alfa Romeo to this day. A quote,
"Elegant and sporty, technologically avant-garde, and projecting unmistakable charisma."
Equipped with a monoblock 4-liter 4-cylinder engine, the 24 HP could reach speeds of 100 kilometers an hour, or 60 miles per hour, and was a hit with Italian drivers, 62 miles per hour, excuse me. However, it was just a bit cost prohibitive, to the tune of about 2 years' worth of an Alfa's employee wages.
Whoa, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Morosi then developed the lighter and more powerful Corsa and 40-60 HP, which were competing in races in 1911 and 13, respectively. Morosi then designed Alfa's first Grand Prix car in 1914, aptly named the GP 1914, which had an advanced dual overhead cam engine.
That is really early for that. Huh.
Definitely.
And I'm guessing these cars are actually making 40 horsepower, 60 horsepower, maybe 24 for that original one. They're very literal with their naming. Mm-hmm.
Alfa, even with their low output of handmade cars, was quickly making waves in European racing. Unfortunately, though, with the outbreak of World War I, their racing plans were put on hold for 3 years. Through the first year of the war, Alfa continued to make passenger cars, but the market was shrinking fast. Fortunately for Alfa, Italian entrepreneur and engineer Nicola Romeo swooped in and bought a controlling stake in the company in 1915 before the market bottomed out. The savvy businessman used the tools and equipment on hand to manufacture products to sell to the Italian government, which consisted mostly of munitions, aircraft engines, and other components for the war effort. Alfa made heavy profits through the war's conclusion in 1918, and by 1919, Romeo had bought the company outright. He originally planned on continuing to run it as a munitions manufacturer, but Morosi lobbied for Romeo to divert some of Alfa's military production resources to resume auto manufacturing. Romeo had trepidations. The path to commercial success via racing is a winding one. But after a victory in Mugello and second place in the Targa Florio, Romeo had the racing bug. He was all in on auto manufacturing and changed the company's name from Alfa to Alfa Romeo.
Oh, that's pretty self-centered. That's like if Bart...
He owns it. You know, of course he's going to.
That's like when you changed the name to Dodge Bart.
From the Dodge Dart? After I bought the company?
When you bought the Dodge Dart, right. And you're like, I like this so much, I'm going to name it the Dodge Bart.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool.
I also think it's crazy how it says so much about cars and racing that there are so many stories where people are like, it does us no good to race. We are losing money racing. Mm-hmm. And yet, once somebody does it or sees it, they're like, fuck.
Yeah, cool.
We have to race.
I think it's racing. That, like, when you watch the Olympics and you're like, I think I could break dance better than her.
Nicola Romeo's instincts.
There's too much to unpack there. You could, Joe. That's, in this instance, you could. So.
Nicola Romeo's instincts weren't wrong. Racing success was the fastest way for a fledgling car company to make a name for itself, which in theory leads to road car sales, the lifeblood of a healthy car manufacturer. But due to Italy's slow economy and the astronomical price point of their models, Alfa's total sales barely exceeded the hundreds, putting the company on life support. Fortunately, Romeo wasn't the only big name added to the company that year. That's right, guys.
Enzo Goodyear.
I was going to say, like, Timothy Chalamet or something. On the other side of Milan, a 20-year-old race car driver and recurring subject on Past Gas named Enzo Ferrari had just taken second place at the prestigious Parma Poggio de Bizzetto behind the wheel of a 2.3-liter CMN Tipo. I nailed that one.
You did, but he was 21.
What did I say?
20.
Damn! You know, you win some, you lose some. His driving caught the eye of Alfa driver Giuseppe Campari, who convinced the company brass to sign Ferrari to a contract. Ferrari would round out a quartet of legendary drivers that included Ugo Savoci, Antonio Ascari, who listeners might remember from episode 197, and the aforementioned Giuseppe Campari. They were the Beatles of racing, and their era defined Alfa Romeo's reputation for decades to come. a reputation that saved it several times over. The Ford drivers dominated the racing circuits of the 1920s, and Morosi's designs deserved a ton of credit for the team's success. 1921 marked the competition debut of the 2030 HP ES Sport Alpha, a 4.5-liter beast that led the team to a 1-2 Alfa Romeo finish in Parma. Morosi really advanced Alfa's advantage when he went back and updated this design for the GP 1914 engine, which had been shelved due to the war. The model would be part of Alfa Romeo's first major international win, but also its most tragic loss. I gotta look this thing up. Alfa 20-30 ES. Here we go. That's it.
Did you do the Sport Alpha afterwards?
Oh, Sport Alpha. Sorry.
Same thing?
Same thing. There ain't no freaking way.
Dude, how's that thing winning races? Oh, maybe this one, though. This one.
Does it? Yes. Yeah,
looks a little bit sportier.
That looks a lot sportier. That thing would probably sell for like $7 million.
Yeah, I bet there's some of those up at
Pebble Beach, am I right?
Yeah, where we were.
Yeah.
Did we mention
for less
we were?
Than a seventh of the of
it's
the
true. Yeah. But, you know, we're changed now.
Yeah.
I'm wearing loafers right now.
I can smell it.
Yeah. I don't have socks on. You can wear them without socks.
Yeah. You don't even have to take a shower.
Ever.
What? Where did you get that?
In the early 1920s, the world's toughest and most prestigious race was the Targa Florio. The race was founded in 1906 and winded through the mountains, rustic villages, and spectacular coastal roads of
mountains,
Sicily.
Yeah. Alfa's Achilles heel.
Oh. Oh, yeah. That's my motherland, you know.
Sicily.
Yeah.
What's
the Isle of Man, isn't that?
No, it doesn't. The Isle of Man doesn't have the wheat.
I think you got the wrong tattoo.
what's that?
I was going to ask what your cousin's restaurant was called.
Sala.
Sala.
If you live in Milwaukee or close to Milwaukee, check out Sala. It's next to the UWM campus. Get the arrabbiata. Get the eggplant parmesan.
The eggplant parmesan is one of the best things I've ever eaten. And, yeah, the restaurant is great, and your family should be very, very proud. I think they are.
They're just celebrating their 22nd, 23rd. Anniversary.
Great Sicilian food. That's the point I'm making here. Yeah, Sicilian food. It's excellent. Go check out Sala.
Yeah.
Alfa had been competing in the race since 1911, but they had never won. Ugo Savoci was determined to change that. In 1923, after a string of third and second place finishes, the superstitious Savoci was convinced he simply needed a bit more luck to reach the top of the podium. Before the race, he took a can of green paint and drew a four-leaf clover, or quadrifoglio, on the nose of his red 3-liter six-cylinder RL. From the moment the race began, Savoci drove his heart out. 7 hours and 18 minutes later, he stood atop the podium, victorious. Savoci had the monkey off his back and the key to victory, and began painting the quadrifoglio on his car ahead of every race. Alfa's profile had never been higher.
Italians are very superstitious. My mom, if I ever spill salt, she makes me throw it over my shoulder. If you're in the kitchen and you accidentally sweep someone's feet, that person has to spit on the broom.
What?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's interesting. I've always been very envious of people with...
conviction.
I was going to say traditions.
I see.
Yeah, convictions. Yeah. Yeah.
I think they're not healthy. I don't think spitting on a broom is going to save your life.
I guess that's another way of looking at it, I suppose. Yeah.
Yet your mom's still here.
That's true. Yeah. Do you have any superstitions, Bart? Stepping on cracks?
Not really. I'm trying to think if there's something... Not that I adhere to...
Yeah,
consistently. I do always look if there's clovers.
I do look for clovers.
Four leaf clovers.
Yeah,
that's not for
beyond that yard for hours.
It's kind of cool. Yeah.
Do you ever see? You know, because it's like bad for cows to eat clover. It gives them enough gas that their stomachs can explode.
Wow.
So some of them have
been there.
A little valve, and like kind of drilled through their stomach, and it's like a plastic valve, almost like you would have a colostomy bag or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And if a farmer sees that their stomach is like super bloated, they just go, and it, all this gas comes out. It's really crazy.
Could have used that last night, let me tell you.
I know. Yeah, dude.
What was, is there a story there?
Or you just some, I don't know, some spicy rumblings.
Spicy rumblings for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just another day ending in Y.
He ate too many Sour Patch Oreos. They taste like they're really bad for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they,
it had
like,
an immediate, as soon as I swallowed it, it had an immediate effect on how my, on how I was feeling.
You had the powder in your throat. You started coughing.
Yeah. It like kind of like dripped. It's just weird.
I think we need more oversight on this, on processed food, to be honest.
Well, I'm trying to provide snacks that you can find at every gas station, you know? I don't want to do the...
It's probably a good thing they come in that tiny packaging.
That was not a tiny package of Oreos.
It wasn't like a full-size.
That package. Yeah, that's, it's disguised in a square, fair, so you think it's less. Don't do it. Don't justify it.
There's probably 75 cookies in there.
Well, despite the high profile and the lucky Quadrifoglio guys, tragedy was about to come for the team. On the morning of September 8th, 1923, Savoci was running late for a scheduled practice ahead of the Italian Grand Prix at Monza, and he didn't have time to paint his talisman. It was raining heavily that day, but Ugo drove aggressively, wanting a good read on the pace. Rounding the Violone curve on his third lap, he lost control of his car and veered off course, smashing into two trees and dying instantly. Damn. He was 38 years old. The corner is now known as Variante Ascari, so named for claiming the life of Alberto Ascari, son of Antonio, 3 decades later. Wow. And since that fateful day, every Alfa Romeo race car has been adorned by Savoci's hallmark Quadrifoglio, and since the 1960s, the emblem has made its way onto Alfa's sportiest road cars.
It's weird they would name the curve after the second guy that died there.
Well, it's Ascari, so it's kind of like...
Yeah. Savoci was like a big dude back then.
But I don't think, like, it's like one guy dies with that name, it's still, you know, dead man's curve. Two guys die with that name. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
It's Ascari's.
Yeah.
He's the dead man.
Yeah.
So. Ugo Savoci looks like a young Tom Selleck.
Wow. Really?
Also, Joe, I'd like, maybe you should reassess your evaluation of talismans and superstition.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it might have worked.
I every time I get in my car, I squat 3 times. I go, and I get in my car. Dude, someone ran into our RAV4 already.
What?
I mean, the rear quarter panel is scratched up. Like someone parallel parked and scratched it, but it's really high and it's white. And I'm pretty sure it's this white truck on my car, on my street.
Yeah.
But we have less than 200 miles on that car.
Damn, dude, that sucks. You gotta take it over to Sandro, you could probably fix it.
Yeah.
You buff it out? You think it'll buff out?
They're kind of deep. They're but it's only in the plastic cladding, so it's like whatever.
Oh, the plastic cladding, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I could even maybe Sharpie it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I was in Mexico and I wiped out on a moped.
Oh,
God. Kind of popped up off a curb and... Just scraped up my leg and my arm, and the bike, and I was like, what am I gonna do?
Yeah, you want to pay?
So, super glued the mirror back on, and got a Sharpie, and some polish, and like I got a little worried because I was like, this looks way better than when I.
you went too hard in the other direction?
Yeah, I did. Anyways, took it back and I was like, it's right out there. He's like, great.
Nice.
Out.
Yeah, and you're just bleeding.
That's right. I was trying to walk normal, you know. I did not wipe out.
Yeah. I didn't ask.
Okay, well, I didn't.
Did you make these steps higher? They're harder.
The team would suffer another tragic loss a few years later when Antonio Ascari died while racing in the French Grand Prix at the Autodrome de Montelli. Yeah, jeez. That's what I said. But the legacy of these drivers and the spirit of this era lives on.
So that's the original Ascari. And then his son,
Alberto,
whose the curve is named after, died, I think, in the 30s or 50s.
Like
30
years
like
later, it said. Yeah. 1923, with both a string of important victories and the death of one of its most important drivers, was a critical year for the team. This also saw Ferrari's aspirations beyond driving emerge when he lured stud designer and engineer Vittorio Jano away from Fiat to join the Alfa Brain Trust. Jano?
Sure.
I mean,
Jano. I honestly don't even
the
know.
Longer we Sorry. Hang on it, Nolan.
Giano made an immediate yeah. and lasting impact. That sounds better.
Yeah.
And would later become the company's second chief designer a few years later. His first design for the company was the highly advanced P2, which featured a straight eight supercharged engine.
Damn.
It was to be Alfa's pride and glory and was assembled in secret so it can make a surprise debut at Cremona in 1924. It won its race with a wildly impressive average speed of 98 miles per hour. The car became the icon Alfa had hoped it would be, taking 14 total Grand Prix wins by 1930.
Damn. Yeah, this thing looks fast.
Team Alfa Romeo was so dominant in the 20s that fans of other teams would heckle Alfa drivers from the grandstands. Giano was happy to play the villain role. He was so confident that his creations would win, he would eat three-course meals during race, during the race to show his lack of concern.
Oh, man, Italians.
The P2 claimed victory after victory, and Giano continued to design race cars. In 1927, series production began on the Alfa Romeo 6C. The six-cylinder engine, hence the cool name, displaced 1,486.6 cubic centimeters and initially offered 46 brake horsepower at 4,000 RPM.
Was a 1.5-liter six-cylinder?
Yeah.
Makes 46 at that time, that seems like more than normal. Mm. I don't know.
A few thousand of the luxury sports cars were sold, but the 6C was built for one thing and one thing only, fellas. Racing. It would prove its potential a few iterations later. So, to this day, Alfa Romeo's reputation is based on their gorgeous design, their exhilarating drive, and admittedly, reliably unreliable mechanics. Those are also accurate descriptors for the company as a whole in the 1920s. While it roared to victory on the track, its road car efforts were much less successful. Which becomes a problem since consumer sales are what pays the bills at the racetrack. In 1921, the company released its first luxury vehicle under its new Alfa Romeo badge, the G1, designed by Marossi. It was the largest model Alfa had released yet, with a 6.3-liter inline-six engine, Damn. Putting it into competition with the likes of automakers like Rolls-Royce.
So each cylinder was over a liter.
Yeah. Damn. That's a lot of Faygo. Sorry, that's what I go to.
It's all right. It's an atmosphere.
It was offered in torpedo and limousine styles with bodywork by Schipati. I'm just going to... But
I think when in doubt with Italian, pronounce all of the vowels.
Schipati.
That's Where? A good...
Schipati.
Schipati. That's a good rule
Oh,
of thumb.
This is... Yeah. That's a K sound.
Schipati.
Schipati.
Schipati. But...
Rolls-Royce.
The G1 sales were handicapped by its home country thanks to Italian car taxing schemes, which base taxes, on the size of the vehicles.
So kind of like how Japan does nowadays.
Sort of, yeah. Of the 50 G1s made, not one was sold in Europe, and the entire batch was shipped off to Australia. Marossi's next design, the aforementioned RL, didn't fare much better in the public sector. While the racing model holds a special place in Alfa Romeo's history, the road version was twice the weight of its sibling and sold modestly due to its low-powered engine.
I wonder why it was so heavy. Just because of the coach stuff? Like the...
Probably.
Leather?
Probably all the big weights they put in it, too.
Yeah, they wanted it to... Every time it went over a speed bump, they wanted it to bounce up.
Yeah. Like they put a bunch of weights in the back.
There was, like... Little race cars when we were kids that you put a penny in the back.
Yeah.
And what would the penny do? I can't remember.
It'd let it pop wheelies.
Oh, okay.
So, like, normally it would go around, but then you put the penny in, and if it hit something, it'd pop up.
Yeah.
And kind of go in a circle.
Oh, that's sick. Now the kids are just playing with their iPads.
Yeah. Talking about Riz and... does Oliver say Riz?
No, but he says bro. He's five. I go, bro! Have you seen this? And I'm like, I'm your dad. It drives me nuts. And it's like,
I'm your dad.
I want to know, like, I'm listening to other dads
yeah.
to be like, who taught their kid yeah. bro?
Who do I have to beat up?
Yeah, I want to have words. And then the kids were together for a while, my daughter and my son. And by the end of the week, Ivy was saying bro.
Oh,
my God. And she's three. She's yeah. like, bro, I do not like the way the sandwich is. She's very willful. She's very articulate. Please continue. Bro, continue with the story.
Bro thought he is him.
Bro, you're not that guy.
That's so funny. Another problem Alpha had was that it had yet to establish a dealership network. Kind of hard to sell cars if you don't yeah. have that. The company struggled, falling further and further into debt to continue funding its successful racing division. While Romeo's guidance through World War I saved the company and set it on a path for success, it was clear that he didn't have a grasp on the commercial auto industry. And by 1925, the Italian government had taken over Alfa's debts, and in 1928, it ousted Romeo. When the stock market crashed in 1929, the company's financial situation became even more dire. One of Alfa's only saving graces through the early depression, at least in terms of image, was their racing team. The same year of the stock market crash, Ferrari founded his own racing team, Scuderia Ferrari, under Alfa Romeo's banner, which continued Alfa's racing success into the 1930s. Long-time listeners, will remember that whole story from episodes 1 through 4. But on the road-going side of the business, it almost seemed like Alfa's designers weren't even thinking of their work as transportation. They were creating art in the form of the most elegant and iconic road cars of the decade, like the 6C 2300 Superleggera and the 8C 2900 Lungo.
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 Hey, Lungo.
Usable Italian performance. The Giano-led design team was digging a hole in quicksand, and in 1933, the company went bankrupt. The state treasury considered closing down the company entirely until the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini himself, a racing enthusiast, intervened. He hired engineer Ugo Gobbato as managing director to straighten out production and to provide guardrails for the impractically creative Giano. The Italian government eventually took full control and became the official car of Mussolini's fascist regime, quite possibly saving the company.
I like the idea of being like, oh, we're going under. And somebody's like, nah, we're saved.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, who is it?
Mussolini. But then Mussolini had to be like, he's a little crazy. Like, can you, you know, bumper bowling? Can you make sure he still hits a strike, but, you know, keep him on track?
But as state control finally stabilized Alfa's road car business, Alfa Racing hit its first rough patch. As discussed in Past Gas, episode 67 on Hitler's racing team, Nazi Germany was pumping a ton of money into its racing program to showcase Nazi ideals of, quote, Aryan supremacy on the racetrack. And in 4 straight seasons, from 1935 to 1939, a Mercedes Silver Arrow car won the European Grand Prix Drivers' Championship. Mussolini was getting a little tired of coming in second to his rival dictator in Germany, but Italy simply didn't have the funds that Germany did to compete. As Alfa's managing director, Gobbato knew that action was necessary. He made some serious waves and hired Spanish engineer Wilfredo Ricart as the new technical director to modernize the team, the first non-Italian in Alfa's history to hold the position.
I love the name Wilfredo.
Ricart was left high and dry with Giano's departure to Lancia a short while after. Giano's departure marked the end of an era. His legacy at Alfa marked 14 years of immense racing success, highlighted by several revolutionary designs like the P2 and 6C that would become icons in the sport. After Giano's exit, Gobbato continued his shakeup by giving his new technical director, Ricart, control over Alfa's racing program. Naturally, this infuriated Ferrari, who had already butted heads with the intellectual. Gobbato tried to ease tensions, but ultimately, Ferrari would not be tamed. After 20 years, he left Alfa Romeo in 1939 to start his own company.
I never knew why he left. I thought it was, I don't know what I thought. I thought it was like creative differences, but I didn't realize it was like this new guy coming in.
Yeah.
You know,
You don't know the vision I have.
I'm gonna win.
I don't want to do it.
You're not gonna stoop that low?
It's a me, Benito.
As close as it'll get.
Yeah.
With two figures on Alpha's own Mount Rushmore gone, all attention now was on Ricard. For road cars, perhaps his most significant contribution to Alpha was his inclusion of the Dedeon tube. Tube? Okay. Tube.
There was an old science garage on tubes.
Tubes.
Yeah, how Hell tubes yeah. work. I still watch it once in a while because it was really funny. And I was like, there's no way they're going to actually do it. And they did it. Even Eddie did it. And there's like a secret link to how tubes work.
It's unlisted.
Work.
You have to like do homework to
it
find
was,
it.
It was something about, it was buried in traffic lights? I forget what you were covering.
Traffic lights?
No, it was linked to, there was something about.
A wheelhouse episode?
Yeah, the wheelhouse was something, and it was, you got into this slight tangent into traffic lights. And he said, and some are powered by tubes. If you want to know more about tubes, check out this science garage. And that was the only way you could link to it was through your video.
Tubes, how do they work?
And it is like 2 minutes of tube talk. Yeah. It's pretty funny, man. So anyway, tube, the Dedeon tube.
So you want to know more about the Dedeon tube?
We're going to talk about the tube right now. In the 1930s, engineers were discovering the limitation of live axle and swing axle rear ends on their increasingly powerful race cars. The Dedeon tube was a form of non-independent suspension that remained a defining spec of Alpha vehicles into the 90s, featured on cars like the Alfetta, the GTV, Giulietta, and the SZRZ. At the track, Ricard's debut car design was a big swing, the Tipo 162. The 162 was an unbelievably complex V16 Grand Prix car that featured five superchargers, 64 valves, and the potential to revolutionize the sport. But before it ever had the chance to prove itself, a little thing called World War II happened.
Oh, that ruins everything. I want to see this thing rip.
After the war broke out in Italy in June 1940, the government ordered Alfa to devote all of its resources to the war effort, primarily designing and manufacturing truck and plane engines. It was hardly a secret that the world-famous auto manufacturer was a primary supplier to the Axis powers, and Alfa quickly became a target of the Allies. Can you imagine flying a plane knowing that you have an Alfa Romeo engine under the hood?
Is that good or bad?
Yeah, what?
I'd be a little worried.
Oh, you're talking about the reliability.
Yeah, I'm making a reliability joke.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be sketchy as hell.
Their plant was bombed twice in 1943, but the factory was able to rebuild each time and continue to operate until a final bombing in 1944 that almost completely destroyed it. Italy was broke and no longer had the resources to make the repairs, and the shop sat idle until the war ended a year later. But even as the war was coming to a close, Alfa's troubles were far from over. After the promising Ricard retired to Spain, Ugo Gobato was murdered outside of the Alfa plant on April 28, 1945. Sources differ on why he was targeted. Some say this was because he was wrongfully accused of collaborating with German and Italian fascists. Others say it was the Gestapo. I mean, wasn't he hired by Benito?
Yeah, Mussolini was dragged and hung in the square and stabbed and shot. Yeah. So if he was a cohort of Mussolini, it only makes sense.
Italian? Benito Mussolini hired Ugo Gobato.
Yeah, and installed him.
Yeah, so I'd say he was collaborating just a little bit.
Yeah, I'd say he was benefiting off of fascism a little bit.
All that. So, to fill the
The whole car company was.
Yeah, that's true. At least Enzo got to be like, I wash my hands of you.
Yeah. To fill the void, as we talk about in episodes 1 through 4, I mean, Enzo was also hanging out at parties with Benito Mussolini and the rest of the party there in Italy at the time.
Yeah, but he was like in the garage playing ping pong.
Nah.
That's what he told me,
Don't try to.
I'm just kidding. I think he was probably a shithead.
He was hanging out. To fill the void created
we're going
to
find you.
Yeah, I know, right? In the town square, the LA town square.
That's right.
To fill the void created by Gobato's murderer, Pasquale Gallo was brought in to demilitarize production. The job of stepping into Ricard's shoes and towing Alfa out of the rubble fell to Ozzoria Sato from our introduction.
Orazio
Sata. Sata joined Alfa's design team in 1938, working for barely a year before Alpha transitioned into war mode. 8 years later, he had achieved his dream and inherited a shell of a company.
Great. Thank you, guys, for taking such good care of my moped.
Even before the outbreak of World War II, Alpha was reeling from bankruptcy and the stormy exit of its star race team manager. Now, it had been bombed to high heavens and had its senior leader shot to death. Looking ahead, they had neither the raw materials to build cars nor a consumer market to buy them. They started small, manufacturing household items to get things back up and running. They made fidget spinners.
Blenders?
At the same time, the government was eager to get its war veterans and restless citizens back to work. Hey, don't kill me. Which was great for Alpha, who suddenly had a huge labor supply at its disposal. Gallo and Satta had the Milan factory up and running by 1946, but the company's fate hung in the balance on what they decided to do next. During the war, several divisions of the company and the contents of some of Alpha's warehouses were scuttled out of Milan into the hinterlands to avoid Allied bombings. At one of these sites, Satta uncovered the prototype for a 6C2500 Gazelle that Ricard had designed before the war but never built. While the design was a decade old, the technology held true, and it inspired Satta's next move. Under Satta's guidance, Alpha would become commercially viable while maintaining its identity as a classic Italian auto manufacturer, for better and for worse. Much like its emblem's depiction of the Bisciglione, Alfa Romeo was about to emerge from the mouth of the serpent, reborn as royalty. But that's next time in part two, the history of Alfa Romeo.
Oh, okay.
A lot of pronunciation.
You got through it, dude.
You
did a great job.
Thank you.
This makes me want to do an episode on the Piaggio Ape, which was a tiny little three-wheeled truck got Italy out of their post-war slump.
Huh.
It is like a national hero over there, just based off of, you know, it's like workhorse reputation.
Totally.
But this Alpha, it's cool to, you know, hear the backstory of their racing pedigree before the war and how they're just a big shot and all the, you know, these names that we've heard over and over again come out of it.
Yeah.
So,
man,
I'm excited to hear the second part.
Yeah. This episode makes me want to get some eggplant parm going.
We should go to the Targa Florio.
That'd be cool.
That'd be sick. They still run to this day. I'm pretty sure.
We just booked our honeymoon tickets, Chloe and I, to Greece, which is not Italy at all, but it's
bring a lot of cash.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get discounts if you pay in cash because no one wants to pay taxes.
Okay, cool. Will do. We got some listener mail this week.
Yeah, this is from Robert. I just wanted to say how grateful I am for the people that make Past Gas. The last month has been one of the worst of my life. I'm basically having to completely start over. Listening to the podcast has helped me so much and made things a little easier. I started listening years ago, but the last couple of weeks I started listening to multiple episodes a day. Thank you all for everything you do. Even though I'm sad, I'm trying to keep it juiced. Robert from Lubbock, Texas.
Keep it juiced, Robert.
Keep it juiced, Robert. We've been there before. Mm-hmm. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. It gets better. You just got to power through and remind yourself every day the little wins. And, you know, we've all gone through hard times, and I think
it gets better, you know, like a month from now, you'll feel a little less sad. 6 months from now, you'll definitely feel less sad. And then a year from now, you'll be like, you'll be in a good spot again.
So yeah. Also, it's okay to feel sad.
Yeah, that's
totally
fine. Totally, man. Yeah. Absolutely.
Just celebrate those tiny wins, though.
Yeah, absolutely. So hang in there, Robert. Keep it juiced. And if you'd like to send us an email, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com.
Yeah, right? That's it.
I don't know why I guess every time.
And if you want to send us a road trip snack for us to review, send it to P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait to eat more cursed Oreos. follow Bart. Is it Bids Bardo still?
Yeah, it's still Bids Bardo. I don't post a lot.
Yeah. Bart doesn't post a lot, but follow him at follow Bids Bardo.
When I do, it's a gem.
Yeah, it's true. Follow Joe at Joji Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to the crew. Edgar Grajeda behind the camera. Gavin Kinzel on the board. Audrey Holden lurking in the background.
And our writer this week, Sam Klemmer. Stay tuned for part two next week. It's going to be a doozy.